It's now a minute after 2 o'clock. This is BBC Radio 3 and it's time for the Early Music Show with Lucy Skeeping. Today, she focuses on the great florid style of 16th and 17th century vocal church music known as polyphony, with the Tallaght Scholars and their director, Peter Phillips.
The connection between polyphony and the actual buildings where it was sung is a fascinating one. Firstly, because I think we all think Gothic, don't we? I mean, the music we listen to is always ideally heard in a cathedral that's a Gothic cathedral. There seems to be no sort of argument about that. But in fact, what we call this music is Renaissance music. And I do wonder why this music is never thought about in the same breath as Renaissance architecture. One of the greatest architects, Alberti, actually wrote, "Beauty can only be achieved through a harmony of all the parts. Nothing can be added, diminished, or altered, but for the worse." Now that seems to me to describe perfectly how polyphony works. Every note counts, every part contributes. The end result is greater than the sum of the parts. And Alberti, in his architecture, produced exactly that principle. In Gothic architecture, it's not quite like that. I mean, there's a more hit-and-miss element in the building of those massive cathedrals, and I don't want that hit-and-miss in my Renaissance music.
Peter Phillips, the founder and director of the Tallaght Scholars, and we heard them performing part of O Sacrum Convivium, a work by their namesake, the Tudor composer Thomas Tallis. In today's Early Music Show, we're focusing on Renaissance polyphony, wonderful intricate choral music like that, that was the crowning glory of the 16th and 17th centuries. And we'll be exploring it through the work of the Tallaght Scholars, a pioneering group who, for more than 30 years, have been on something of a crusade to bring this very individual style of church music into the concert world. We'll be hearing more from Peter Phillips throughout the programme, and also from some of the singers themselves about the ethos of the group, how they feel this music should be performed, and the particular qualities they bring to it. But before then, back to Peter Phillips. We caught up with him recently in Oswestry, just before he went into rehearsal for a concert which included music by Tallis and Palestrina. He and the group may have been performing this repertoire for many years, but his enthusiasm seems undimmed.
My respect for the polyphonic composers has gone up and up, really. You only have to get to know them better, and I've been doing it for over 30 years, and you come to realise just what wonderful composers they were. I mean, this is the merit of being a specialist, you know, this is all I do. It's like someone who conducts Beethoven symphonies or Germanic symphonies. They come to know those scores really well. And I thought this repertoire was equally worth that kind of specialisation. My knowledge has widened because I've got to know more of the music, but also the way it's written, the way they put these things together has become more and more fascinating to me. What really excites me about polyphony is the way the parts interact. It's a sort of web of melodies, sort of held in space, related to each other, bumping into each other, going their own way but coming back to talk to another part, and so on and so on. One can turn it into a picture. I'm not so interested when it's purely chordal music. What I like is what's called counterpoint or polyphony. It's the same thing, really. It's these melodies interlocking. And in my mind, these set up wonderful patterns in the brain.
Oh.
Talis Scholars, directed by Peter Phillips, with the Sanctus and Benedictus from the Western Wind Mass by the 16th century English composer John Taverner. By far the bulk of the polyphonic repertoire from this period is liturgical. It was music written by jobbing composers specifically for church services, and quite often for a particular choir and a particular church. So its entire purpose was to praise God and to glorify the institution of the Christian church. And yet, for Peter Phillips, founder and director of the Talis Scholars, this music has a life far beyond the church doors.
I was never interested in performing this sacred music in church services. If you perform in a church service, then what you're going to the church for is the religion, is for the worship, obviously, and the music adorns it. I'm not particularly religious. I took the line that this music was very great music by any standards, and I wanted to present it to the public like any great music of any period, mostly later, obviously, in concert halls, in concert series, in a very secular setting. You don't probably have beautiful paintings or beautiful architecture necessarily surrounding you, but you concentrate on the music. That's what we're doing. We're presenting this as a sequence of wonderful pieces as an evening's entertainment.
Palestrina's Surge Illuminare, taken from a live recording made in the Church of Santa Maria Maggiore in Rome in 1994. Arise, shine, O Jerusalem, for your light has come and the glory of the Lord has risen upon you. Palestrina certainly left us with a wonderfully vivacious, luminous setting of that text, but it did make me wonder just how important are the words in this sort of music?
The connection between text and music in polyphony is quite a contentious one, I think. I take the line that, to a certain extent, the meaning of the words informs everything. But in another way, and people who love madrigals will be disappointed here, There's very little madrigalian writing in good church music. So what I'm getting at is that the composer will create a mood in his polyphony that's good for worship, basically, so that the even in a Kyrie or a very neutral text, where you can't express the meaning of the words pictorially in the music, a good composer will create a mood of calm. That lovely sense of being taken out of yourself, out of the rushing world that we live in, and going to a calmer place. The words will suggest that, and a good composer will always be able to create that mood. But the actual business of taking a word and painting it in music, as happens in madrigals, they didn't very often do that. The texts, obviously, were the starting point for every composition, and it would depend on the different composers. Lassus was known to need the words to set his imagination working. I think Palestrina needed it a lot less, and he could create an abstract world, which nonetheless had to start with the words. We're not singing ooh-ah or la, we're singing Kyrie eleison or whatever it is. But there are moments, quite a lot of moments, to be honest, in most of these composers, where you do feel as though the music has become abstract, and nowhere more so than in settings of the Lamentations, where you get the Hebrew letters are set to these beautiful passages of music, which literally are meaningless. It's just a letter, Aleph, doesn't mean anything except A, and yet you get this fantastic music. It's like consort music then.
Thank you.
devotional music by the Tudor composer Thomas Tallis, his first setting of the Lamentations of Jeremiah. You're listening to The Early Music Show with me, Lucy Skeeping, and all through today's programme, we're exploring Renaissance vocal polyphony with Peter Phillips and the Tallis Scholars. It was back in the 1970s that the group first came to the attention of concertgoers, a time when interest in early music and period performance practice was becoming very fashionable. But just how important was it to Peter back then to stick strictly to that sort of early music performance style? Was period performance practice foremost in his thinking when he founded the group?
I always thought the early music movement that came along in the early 70s, which was when we started, was really to do with the finding of old instruments and learning how to play them, what sound they could make, and therefore what changes should be made to performances that were using modern instruments. And clearly these modern instruments were not satisfactory. You had the old instruments as an exemplar. It was a good idea to play the music on these old instruments. Now, we couldn't do that. There are no recordings of the voices. So this was both good and bad. I mean, it meant that we couldn't be told what to do. And actually, I went even further and refused to do the join in the fads of those days, which was the funny Latin pronunciation that was sort of French or German or English or something. And I always felt that interrupted the flow of the singing because the singers were thinking too hard about these funny vowel sounds and so on. So basically, I just cut loose. I mean, I just decided that I was going to take a great piece of music, get the best singers I could find, and make it convincing for us. I never thought using children was going to be, and I suppose boys, we mean, was going to be practical or frankly desirable. When it came to touring, we have to live very difficult days. We have to do long flights and possibly sing at the end of them. Children are just not equal to this. In a way, it was a practical decision. I love the way children sing. My son is a chorister right now. But I never thought it was necessary to have that sound. And once again, I mean, how do we know how those kids sang in the 16th century? They were apparently rather older than children are now. Their voices broke later. You know, they were sort of fully grown. They could have supported their voices as a grown person, adult, whilst actually not having had enough protein or whatever it was for their voices to break. I think this is the theory. So I don't think we know, once again, and I'm personally not bothered, so I don't have to be held to account in this way. The very first encouragement I had was listening to King's College, Cambridge, under Wilcox in the early 60s, especially that recording of the Allegri with Roy Goodman. This wasn't quite right, and I knew it wasn't quite right, but it was very good, and it was markedly different from what you got from the professional choirs of those days, which were just wobblers. I mean, they were a nightmare to listen to. I won't name names. So King's were getting, you know, pretty nearly there. But then I went to Oxford and I heard a group called the Clerks of Oxenford. They had women and not boys, and they produced a sound which just riveted me. I mean, I'll never forget it, the first time I heard them. I mean, I was just dazed for a long time afterwards. It wasn't that they sang very loudly. I think what we've learnt in the intervening years, how to project the sound into a place like the Sydney Opera House building, you know, a big building. We're not mic'd in those buildings. We have to hit them between the ears at a distance. And the Clerks never got to that stage. But they produced this very beautifully blended sound. And it was this, it had this agility that I loved so much. All the parts were sort of ticking away in perfect rhythm. It was the rhythm that was so good, as well as the line. It was a big group. I mean, it could well go up to 20 people and have four to a part. It was a little bit white for my, what I call white for my taste. I don't wish to criticise at all. The white sound came from using very young singers and lots of them. So no one projected. I mean, they used to stand there and make a tiny noise, actually, which, of course, on record, you can capture perfectly satisfactorily. In concert, it wasn't always quite so successful. We've come to a more colourful version than that now. Salvator,
Salvator Mundi by Thomas Tallis, performed by the Clerks of Oxenford, conducted by David Woolston. The Clerks were very much at the forefront of the rediscovery, if you like, of Renaissance polyphony. In the 1960s and 70s, they were one of the first groups to really introduce it to a wider audience. In fact, they were almost evangelical when it came to this repertoire. So how does their sound compare with what the Tallis scholars are doing today, some 50 years down the line?
I had a sonic ideal in my head when I started. That was based on what I heard around me at Oxford. It was a very well-tuned sound and agile. It wasn't heavy. The well-tuned thing immediately brings into the question of vibrato, which of course is kind of out of tune, but I never wanted it to be completely white. I wanted the sound to be coloured. So what we've had to do over the years really is develop the voices so that they could sing in a colourful way and really strongly. What I also don't want is this wretched half voice or quarter voice singing that some people think is appropriate to early music. The Americans are particularly prone to this. I want people to sing, and I want the audience to see that we're going for it. You know, the loud bits are really powerful. And also, that way, my singers don't lose their voices. It's actually very easy to lose your voice on a tour if you're not singing properly. Got to stand and deliver. Now, the problem was, if you're dealing with good singers, trained singers, modern singers, if they're going to sing loudly, they're going to sing with some vibrato, and then the tuning will become affected. So what we've done, I think what we've done in the last 20 years anyway, is encourage a generation of young singers to sing fairly straight and not lose the central pitch of the note, which may go against their training as opera singers and in the colleges and so on, but sing really strong. Maybe a good place to look for this kind of what I would call modern Tallis scholars powerful singing would be the recording of the Missa Pape Marcelli we made about 2 or 3 years ago now. The Palestrina itself is so beautifully written in its sonorities that the chords really ring. But if you sing those chords with too much vibrato, they won't ring. The notes will bump into each other and you won't get a beautiful sound in the building. Now, when we recorded it in Merton College Chapel, we were going for it. There are two bass parts and two tenor parts, and there were two singers on each part. And yet, they were singing flat out, really loudly at times, thrillingly loudly. And you get to those last chords of B-flat, they wham into those chords, and they just sit there, and the whole place pulsates with the sheer ringingness of this beautifully tuned sound. And yet, these are modern trained singers, with voice lessons coming out of them for many years, really singing in tune.
Thank you.
the Missa Papae Marcelli by Palestrina, performed by the Tallis Scholars, directed by Peter Phillips. So how do the singers themselves regard what they do? And what are some of the defining qualities of being a Tallis Scholar? Let's hear from some of the folk on the front line.
My name's Donald Gregg, and I'm a bass in the group.
Simon Wall, tenor.
Patrick Craig, I'm one of the altos in the group. I'm a countertenor.
Janet Coxwell, I'm one of the four sopranos.
One's function as a bass in most music is as a harmonic foundation, whereas Renaissance polyphony, which tends to be more democratic in terms of the voices and in terms of what the voices do, means we actually get to sing tunes now and then. We're not simply providing the root of the harmony and so on. So for us, it's more expressive, let's say, than other later music.
If you look at some of the larger groups that perform this kind of music, what you'll find is that there are lots of sopranos and fewer altos, tenors and basses. Whereas in this group, generally speaking, there are the same amounts of singers on each part, and so there's a sort of an equality throughout, which goes with what Don was saying about the basses being just as important as everyone else.
You have the choice of one to a part, like the Hilliard Ensemble does, or you can have three or four to a part, in which case the four won't be interacting with each other perfectly. They will be physically separated from each other by somebody else. I wanted two because they're standing right there, they can hear exactly what the other person is doing, and react, blend in, make the line work. The moment you have more than two, you lose something of that subtlety. I wanted that flexibility of people who can hear each other within the whole ensemble and make the lines interesting as a twosome. There is good evidence, I would have thought, that this was the way they went in the cathedral choirs of today, and they're exactly the same size as they were in the 16th century. It's customary to have two on each part on each side, except in the boys. But I don't use boys, I use adult women, so they're treated exactly the same, and I have two on a part with them as well.
We work quite a lot on blend, with trying to blend between a pair as well as within the group.
In the case of the basses and also the other parts as well, you tend to have a slightly lower voice and a slightly higher voice. That's very obvious in the basses because we have a real bass and I'm a higher baritone. So one might think on the face of it that it's going to be quite difficult to combine those two voices. Somehow it works. The image I always have is of creating a third sound between the two of us. And usually it's Rob McDonald is the other bass. I think of it as a sort of spinning silver ball into which one's putting one's voice. And when it's going perfectly, neither one of you is in control of it. It's also a bit like the glass that you have with the Ouija board. Neither one of you is controlling it, but somehow it's spelling out the letters.
We have to be careful. You know, the higher it gets, obviously, the more difficult it is to balance it. Lower down, it is much easier. We can be quite loud when we get quite high.
People, when I first joined the group, talked a lot about how, I suddenly heard this thing going on in the concert that I hadn't heard before, and the thing took another direction at the last minute, and it was an amazing moment for me to realise that you don't have to sit on that individuality, you don't have to squash that. I think there is an opportunity in a group of this size for your musical ideas to impact on the live performance. It doesn't have to be a planned, I want to do this, does everyone agree, can we do it like that in a rehearsal? It's just an actual here and now experience, which for us as music makers is an exciting thing to get a chance to do it like that.
You also know the other voices in the group, so you know their strengths and so on. So for example, Patrick might have a particular phrase and I might see it coming and I might hear him doing it, and therefore I might respond in the same way. There is a sense of call and response and answering and musical communication. The strange thing about it is that very rarely is this spoken about. I mean, this is one of the few occasions where we're talking about it now.
This group, to me, is such a performance-based group. We rehearse, we put certain details in, but the glorious thing about us singing together in a concert, which is what Don has already enunciated, is that so many details come out as we live the music, as we sing the music.
The thing that really gets me are final chords. If you get a final chord and all the voice parts have slotted into the right bit and the tuning is absolutely bang on, it is the most amazing experience, right down from the bottom up to the top. It's fantastic. I'm always saying how much I love the Victoria Requiem, and there are lots of fantastic final chords at the end of that, and they're really thrilling to be part of. And I don't think I'm ever going to get bored of being part of that.
The Sanctus and Benedictus from the Requiem by Tomás Luis de Victoria, performed by the featured group in this week's early music show, the Tallis Scholars, with their conductor, Peter Phillips. The programme was presented by Lucy Skeeping and produced by Chris Wines. And of course, you can listen to it again for the next 30 days via the BBC Radio 3 website. We'll have more choral sounds in just under 10 minutes in Choral Evensong at 3 o'clock. And then at 4, Sarah Moore Peach will be here.
On the choir today, I'll be talking to the horn player Richard Watkins of the Nash Ensemble about the moment he made his nail-biting debut as a singer at Wigmore Hall, and he shares some of his favourite choral music with us. Also today, my choral classic at 5 o'clock is one of the towering masterpieces of humanity, Bach's B minor Mass. Join me, Sarah Moore Peach, for our weekly celebration of singing together, the choir, at 4 o'clock.
Well, before Choral Evensong from Salisbury at 3 o'clock, let's hear more 16th century polyphony. And the setting of the Liberame from the Requiem Mass is by Alonso Lobo, a contemporary of Tomás Luis de Victoria, whose music we've just heard at the end of the early music show. He probably wrote this for the funeral of King Philip II of Spain in 1598. Harry Christophers conducts the 16. Libera me domine de morte eterna by Alonso Lobo, sung by the 16, conducted by Harry Christophers. This is BBC Radio 3. Sarah Moore Peach is here with this week's edition of The Choir in an hour's time at 4 o'clock. And then at 5.30 we'll be looking to the skies, poetry, prose and music on the theme of the sky and the objects in it in Words and Music at 5:30. Now, though, at 3:02, we come to Choral Evensong, which was first broadcast last Wednesday live from Salisbury Cathedral. The canticles are from the second service by Thomas Tomkins, and the anthem, published in 1589, is by William Byrd, Civitas Sancti Tui, Your Holy City Has Become a Wilderness. The service begins now with a setting by Michael Wise of verses from the first chapter of the Book of Lamentations, The Ways of Zion Do Mourn, Because None Come to the Solemn Feasts.